1930 recording of the Bugle Call Rag, recorded by the Chocolate Dandies with Benny Carter and Coleman Hawkins. Well, coming up on Fresh Air, we meet Steve Sabol of the NFL Films. NFL Films was created 15 years ago by my guest Steve Sabol and his father, Ed Sabol. They now put more film on television than any other TV production company, even more than Mary Tyler Moore Enterprises. NFL Films shoots more than 375 miles of football footage a year, and they have become the largest user of 16mm film in the world. I'm sure you've seen some of their programs on TV. During the football season, NFL Films produces a weekly show for home box office, plus 2 half-hour shows that are syndicated nationally, The Game of the Week and This is the NFL. They also produce the halftime film that is shown during the ABC Monday night game, and they do the pre-game features for NBC and CBS. Their off-season shows include NFL Scrapbook, plus coverage of non-football sporting events like tennis, golf, and horse racing, not to mention rock concerts, one of which they just completed with Aerosmith and Ted Nugent. They commission their own music for the NFL shows. Some of this music has been released on records. We just heard a sample. We'll be hearing more a little later. NFL Films is based in Philadelphia. Their building's at 230 North 13th Street in Philadelphia. My guest, Steve Sabol, is the executive vice president. That doesn't mean that he sits at a desk and administrates all day. He still shoots, edits, and writes, as well as helping to steer the direction of the company. Steve Sabol, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
NFL Films has an interesting relationship to the NFL. Can you tell us about how one grew out of the other, how the NFL's interest in film
Originally, Pete Rozelle, who's probably the most farsighted of all sports commissioners, saw the value of film and how it could be used, and our company was formed as in an effort to promote the National Football League. It's sort of a sophisticated form of propaganda, but that isn't to say that we are censored by Pete Rozelle. That's not true at all. It's just that all of us love sports and enjoy it. And I think if someone had told us, if we formed a separate company, that all of our films would basically be the same way they are now. We love football. We think that its prime function is entertainment, and that's the way our films are geared. We don't make films for it's not nuclear disarmament or cancer research. It's a light entertainment, and our philosophy is that sports are the toy department of life, and our films hopefully reflect that feeling.
Personal end of the story of how the NFL Films got started is a really nice one, which I wish you'd share with us.
Well, it all started when I was in fourth grade, and I used to play on the 70-pound football team at Haverford School. My father at the time was an avid amateur photographer. He'd gotten a 16mm Bell & Howell camera for his wedding, but he was in the coat business, which he despised, and he was bored, and he hated it. And every afternoon when I'd play in the 70-pound team, my dad would sneak out of work, climb up to the top of the chemistry building, and take football movies of me playing on the 70-pound team when I was about in fourth grade. And every year I'd move up in weight, and the film treatment become more elaborate. Dad would shoot more film. And of course, our coaches then were not really coaches. We had an English teacher, a biology teacher, and they really weren't involved in the sophisticated nuances of the game. They couldn't really use the film, but we always used to come over to our house, and all the kids on the team would come over, and we'd have apple cider and cookies and look at ourselves on the movies. But Dad ran into a problem when I left and I went to college. And I went to school in Colorado College. He couldn't fly out there every day to do the film, so I think he got a little restless, and he decided to set his sights a little higher. And in 1962, for $5,000, if you can believe it, he bought the rights to do the NFL championship game, which was the Giants and the Packers. And I remember him calling me up at school and saying, "Steve, you've been at school for 4 years. You've played football all your life. I think it's time to come back and help me put together this football film." So he shot the game was in Yankee Stadium, and it was one of the coldest, most miserable games I can ever remember. And we had four of the cameras freeze, and as a matter of fact, one of the cameramen had frostbite and lost his finger from the filming of the game. But we got all the footage back. We had shot more slow motion than had ever been done before, and that was a big thing in those days. And we changed the music around. We used, instead of using Chris Schenkel, who had been the normal sportscaster, we used John Facenda, who everybody here in Philadelphia was familiar with, but on a national level, no one knew who he was. And he had this, what I say, a retreat from Dunkirk voice. It was very important, and he gave the show a certain drama that sports shows hadn't seen before. And then the show was successful, and Pete Rozelle liked it. All the owners liked it. The next year, we bought the rights again and did it in 1963. And then in 1964, my father came up with the idea, well, look, let's start a company, and we'll do all the games. We'll film all football games. And all the owners thought it was a good idea. It was a good way to promote the game properly. And every team at the end of the year usually had a highlight film. And it was done by various independent companies. But now it was centralized with us in one company. Each team put up $20,000. There were 24 teams in the league then. We used that to buy a building here in Philadelphia. And from there, it just grew into what it is now. And it's like we had spoke before the show, Terry. It's a question of we were right. It was a really good timing that we were right in the beginning of the rise of pro football, along with the rise of documentary filming, and we both sort of grew up together. And I think that good timing is a secret to success in life, in love, life, and business.
Do you see any connections between documentaries of the 30s and 40s or the March of Time series and the way that you shoot and then repackage a football game, you know, with an announcer who has a very authoritative voice with very dramatic music laid underneath it and, you know, editing that is done to help create a dramatic surface for the
film? I think there's probably a lot of comparisons that could be made to all different types of filmmaking and sports. If you go back, you can go back to 1894 when Thomas Edison invented the kinetoscope, which is what we have become to know as a motion picture camera. And the first film he ever did was of a man sneezing. The second film that Edison ever did was of a belly dancer called Fatima. The third film that Edison ever made was of a boxing match. And the next six films that Edison made were all boxing films. And the reason that he did that is that's the thing that people wanted to see on film. And from Edison's time to the present, of course, sports photography has continued to grow in popularity. And there's so many different treatments. What you suggested is true, is that we do use a lot of the same techniques that are used in the old March of Time, the dramatic, the resonant voice as opposed to a sportscaster, because we felt that people hear sportscasters every day in the live broadcast. And we didn't need someone who knows something about football because he has a written script. We just wanted someone who had a good voice who had an affinity for the weight and tone of words and that could read a script and keep your interest and not get on your nerves, while there's a great many sports writers do. And when we found John, he was just on the verge of being phased out of television, and he's found a whole new life with us. He's gone on to do new commercials and new voiceovers, and he's become sort of the voice of NFL films. And there's a joke in the industry. They say that John Facenda could take a laundry list and read it and make it sound dramatic, which is really the truth. And he is become synonymous with NFL films.
There are many moments of my life when I wish I could have really lived through the edited version of it instead of the real-time sequence of it. What are some of the differences between the game as it really happens and the game as it comes out in the half-hour series that you will produce after the fact?
Well, Alfred Hitchcock had a great statement about that, Terry. He said that drama is life with the dull parts cut out. And that's exactly what we do in our football films, the same theory that Hitchcock used in his mysteries, and that we attempt to give a shape, a dramatic curve to the game. In other words, when you see a game on television, well, let me start again and say that every sporting contest has a beginning, a middle, and an end. But it's not really clear the shape or the true understanding of the event is not clear until all this is put into a coherent form. Now, a television broadcast is too immediate. It's too close to the event to render an account of it as a complete form. So here is where the filmmaker has a function that television can't even attempt, by using music, by editing out the dull parts, by using graphic effects, by using different script techniques. We can clarify the dramatic form of the event. In other words, we can make a film and not an instant replay. That's the big difference between us and television. And when people talk about us in the film business, we have a unique challenge. I mean, how many would you go see Star Wars or Jaws if you already knew the chase sequences, if all the dialogue you'd heard before, and you knew how it ended? Well, that's exactly what happens to us when we make a film about the Super Bowl. 130 million people have already seen it. We can't come back and show the same thing. So we have to give a new interpretation of it. So if someone were to ask me to define my job at NFL Films, I'd say it is to give a new understanding and a new perspective to something that has already been seen. To sound like a film professor, I could say we're trying to give a creative treatment to reality. And that's where our how we feel we function in the film community. We don't, you know, we're not creating new stories. We're redefining and reinterpreting things that people have already seen. Whereas your old news broadcasts were pretty much factual accounts of what happened, where we feel that we can varnish the truth a little bit and create. We're interested in entertainment. That's the most important thing. Like I said, sports is just entertainment. It's not a real serious. There are no lofty Milton-esque allegories in any of our films. We're not pretending to be Ingmar Bergman, and our films will not mark any turning point in the history of the human mind. They're just meant for sports and to be entertaining. That's all.
I've gotten the feeling sometimes that one of the emotions that you want to convey through the films is that of, inspiration, of kind of rising
Definitely.
To the occasion and achieving.
Right. I think that a lot of ours think, well, I think that's one of the charms of sport, and that I think one of the reasons for professional football's popularity is that it quenches our thirst for heroic simplicity. I mean, every Sunday it's a world of clear-cut victories and defeats. A world where old-fashioned virtues still prevail, the courage, dedication, the refusal to accept defeat, these old-fashioned virtues, but you see them in effect, and in essence, they're very satisfying, and they're very real.
So what happens when something really dirty happens?
We don't show it.
Uh-huh.
No, it's usually, those are just, you know, little emotional outbreaks. I mean, it's not like ice hockey that really depends on the fights. Professional football, first of all, the fights are meaningless because they have so many pads on that there's no way they can hurt each other. And it's really such an insignificant part of the game that you could go through a whole season and see them, and there may be three or four fights break out. And usually we do show the fights, but we show them in the context of humor. That it's, you know, that the boys, anything when boys will be boys kind of thing, because no one ever gets hurt in a fight. You know, I don't think in the history of pro football any player has ever really been hurt in a fight, because when you punch somebody, he's wearing a helmet, you're just going to hurt your hand. The injuries that do occur in pro football are usually, you know, from the course of a tackle or a block or something, or, you know, your leg gets caught in the turf or something like that. It's not, never comes from a fight or anything like
How
that.
Do you treat injuries?
Well, we just show them just the way that happened, especially if they're critical to a team's success or failure, which they always are. Football is a game of attrition. I mean, they always say that a lot of the times the best teams at the end of the year are not so much the most talented, but the ones that have the most stamina and the ones that are the most healthy. And that's true. It's just violence is a part of the game. It's not the means of the game. It's not the essence of the game. It's just a part of the game. There's strategy, teamwork. There's a great many other aspects to pro football. But it's violence is just an element of the game, and it's a spectacular element, and it's a visual element, and that's why you see so much of it on television, and it's dramatized so much.
Now, another element of the films that you make that I'd like to talk about is the music that you use. And as I mentioned before, NFL Films commissions their own music.
Right.
They don't run out and buy already existing records
Right.
and lay it under the images. What are you using music to achieve in
well,
the films? What are you
I think,
listening and looking for?
That you could go to the fact that, first of all, music is such a part of our everyday life. I mean, when you look at what happens during the course of your every day, you get married to music, you go to war to music, you get buried to music, you make love to music. So it's such an integral part of our everyday living, and that the ancient philosophers considered music one of the basic elements of the universe. And Walt Whitman said that music was the universal language of mankind. Music hits directly at the gut level, and you can communicate through music. And football is such an emotional game that we found that there's so many emotions that we can convey with just a piece of music and action that we don't have to use words at all. And that's why music is, well, you can look at Gone with the Wind, who many people say is the most successful film ever made. There's only 22 minutes in that whole film that does not have music. And that look at High Noon, the great story of that old Western that when Harry Cohn was looking at, he was the president of Columbia Pictures at the time, and he was looking at the movie, it was Gary Cooper and Grace Kelly without Tex Ritter's score, Tex Ritter sung the lyrics, it was Dimitri Tompkin that did the music, and he wouldn't accept it. He said the film was a turkey, he didn't want it. And they then took it over to Universal, and they added the famous High Noon, and they bought it, and the film went on to win an Academy Award and become one of the most famous Westerns. And it just shows you how much music can add to a film. And we believe in music so much, we have our own composer. He lives in Germany. He comes over to Philadelphia twice a year, and we meet, discuss the new trends that we want to do. We go over the melodies. And he goes back to Germany and records in Munich and uses a 65-piece orchestra. And he does an hour's worth of new music every year. And all of our music is original. And we feel proud of the fact that our music is distinctive enough that a lot of people will hear certain types of music now and say, oh, that sounds like NFL Films music. But it's something, Terry, that we have really worked on, and it is one of the we consider that even more important than the script is the music.
Let's listen to some of the music that was written for NFL Films, and we'll come back and talk about it some more. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Steve Sable, who is an executive vice president at NFL Films, and he also shoots, edits, and writes for NFL Films. Now, this is some of the music. This, you wanted to say a few words about this before we hear it. This is called Dance of the Fumblers.
Well, this is, we draw on so many different sources, Terry, for our music, and this is drawn from Rimsky-Korsakov, and it's we felt that a lot of times that classical music has a certain rising tempo to it. It has very strong strings, and then also, in a lot of ways, professional football is a ballet, especially when it's shot in slow motion. And we found that this type of music has a certain vigor and energy, yet also a certain grace to it, that when it's put to football action, that it has a very satisfying feeling to it, and it makes you look at the football action in a different perspective. And that, like I said before, that's one of our objectives at NFL Films, is to take something that you've already seen on television and through a creative interpretation of it, make it look a little different. And this is a piece of music that, when put to football action, would make you probably look at the visual image a little differently than you would normally.
Okay, here it comes.
Thank you.
aptly entitled Dance of the Fumblers. That's just a sample of some of the music that was commissioned by NFL Films for use with the films that they produce, football films. It's also available on the Volume 2 Football League Films albums. There's at least three albums.
Right, and they're all, if you go to a football game, Terry, they're all advertised in the programs.
Uh-huh.
And it's become a really interesting business for us because we never realized we had the shows on television, and we started getting letters about the shows, and most of the letters were about the music. They wanted to know where they could buy the music, who did the music, and so from there we decided we'll put out a record album, and we're already into our third volume.
Interesting. I'm speaking with Steve Sable, who's the executive vice president at NFL Films and also shoots, writes, and edits. NFL Films is located in Philadelphia. It started occurring to me about, I guess, 3 years ago that the music of the times, you know, for news broadcasts and for TV shows and even game shows probably, was becoming disco music. And that really shocked me when I figured that out, because it used to be that anything that came out of rock and roll was avoided by everyone who had to do with TV, and it was always more classically sprung kinds of music that was used as themes for shows. How much have you let disco and other kind of commercial rock forms influence the music that you want for NFL Films?
Well, I think, Terry, you have to stay up to date on a great deal in your music, but we've found that rock music is too narcissistic to be used with our films, meaning that it calls attention to itself too much, and it tends to distract from the story of the film. It's often the effect, we've experimented with it, that when you use we're telling a foot story about a player, it could be a Roger Staubach or an O.J. Simpson, and we go to rock music, that it almost seems as if somebody just switched on an AM radio station right next to the television or the screen, wherever you happen to be watching it, and it never seems to really fit. Disco music we've experimented with is so trendy now, and it's become so much of a cliche that we haven't used as much of it. We started out 2 or 3 years ago using it, and now it's just as you said, you see it on every commercial, every dog food commercial, underarm deodorant commercial, news breaks. It's just something that we've tried to avoid, and we've tried to keep our music distinctive and using different modern elements, but let's say we could take old tunes and use modern interpretations of them. But it's just as you said, you have to be careful with the music, because you don't want, how many times have you heard Rocky or Star Wars? I mean, that's been overkilled now to the point where it's just, when you hear it, you just don't even hear it anymore. It's like a Muzak in an elevator. And music is so important to our movies, because both the sports and music appeal to your sense of wonder and your sense of romance. And that when we lose that in the music, we're really handicapping the film. We're losing a definite, very emotional, visceral effect in the movies that we would be better off if we used a kind of music that's more distinctive and more interesting.
Okay. The kinds of stresses that a camera person for NFL Films is under is really different than what's required of someone who's shooting a film that is going by a script. I mean, when you're on
Certainly.
The sidelines or wherever you are, you don't know what the play is going to be.
Right, we call filming in a near panic situation, and that's why we've done very well in rock concerts. It's just a wild, screaming group of people, and it's a panic situation, and our cameramen are all trained to shoot like that, and we've developed a walkie-talkie system with earphones that all of our cameramen are in constant contact, and we've worked as a team for almost 10 years. We basically had the same staff of 8 or 9 cameramen for the last 10 years, and each one of us has our own style. So when we're in a chaotic situation, we basically will know, well, what this guy's going to be shooting, this guy will be shooting one thing, this guy will be shooting another. So it's when it's all put together, it's a very complete, comprehensive coverage of the event. But we have a basic formula that we use when we shoot, whether it's a rock concert or a boxing match or a football game, and then all our cameramen are divided into 3 categories. We have our top cameramen. They're the basic position you see on television, your main camera. They shoot from a tripod, and they're elevated way above the action. And when you're watching a football game on television, that's what you see primarily. We call them trees because they're rooted in the position. The second type cameraman that we use is a handheld mobile cameraman that shoots on the ground. Because he shoots on the ground, we call him a mole. And 75% of all of our photography, all of our sports photography in the finished film comes from moles. Again, going back to our philosophy that we want to give a new perspective to something that's already been seen. Television does have ground cameras, but they're all on tripods, and they're really they're not as easy to handle, or nor are they as sophisticated as our ground camera equipment. And that's why television, although it has begun to introduce some ground camera photography, still is not nearly as good as ours. And our third type cameraman is a person who is concerned with everything but the action. He just shoots the human interest aspects of the game. The coaches as they're, you know, gnawing on their fingernails, walking up and down the sidelines, the fans. And because he has to pop up in these candid situations, he's called a weasel. And a weasel also can deal with what I call pictorial harmonies, which was a term that Whistler used in a lot of his paintings, that you really don't care what the subject matter is, it's the colors and the patterns. And in a lot of our films, or people that are familiar with our films will see those kind of shots that could be just cleat marks in the mud, or it might be just a pair of, you know, bloody hands rubbing together. It might be a players in their capes running out across the field silhouetted against the cloudy sky. It might be the way a sun sets over the stadium. But all these things are these little details that add up to create a very interesting interpretation of the game. And it's all art is selected detail. And we feel that it's a weasel's job to get these details. So you're dealing then with three different cameramen. You have your trees who cover every play, your moles that shoot from the ground, and your weasels who shoot the human interest and the more artistic abstract shots. And then you blend all, an editor tames and shapes this raw vision of all these cameramen into a, hopefully, a coherent and artistic whole.
Now, you've done, I believe, shooting from the ground.
Yes.
How can you follow the ball around? I mean, okay, the team huddles, they don't tell you the
right
play they're going to do. Someone's going to get the ball and maybe pass it all
right
the way down the field. How do you know where to follow? I mean, it's all happening in real time. And, I mean, I've seen some of your films, and the camera always seems to be on just the right person who's about to catch the ball or, you know, following the ball as mm-hmm. it goes through space.
Well, Terry, first of all, anybody who shoots photography would know that a lot of it is luck. And I would be remiss not to say that a lot of our greatest shots are luck. And that's just the way the nature of our business is. It's spontaneous cinema. You don't know what's going to happen. But there's two things. Number one, it's position. Usually our cameramen have a feeling when it's going to be a pass. I mean, there's obvious passing situations. So therefore, they'll move downfield a little more and they'll be able to follow the ball better. And other times, it's just reactions. Our cameras are specially modified at NFL Films. We have our own factory right in our basement in our office. So we buy basic camera models from California. We bring them to Philadelphia, and they're specially modified for us. The viewfinders are made brighter, and they're much wider. So the average person shooting with his Brownie is trying to follow a ball. It is not the same kind of a viewfinder that we're using. It's specially designed. They're almost like they're patterned after the old P-38 Lightning World War II gun sights that were a very wide, bright scope, and that you could see, anticipate the movement of the ball from one side to the other. But a lot of it is just that this is all we do. We're specialists. I mean, and when you specialize in anything, the more you do it, the better you're going to get at it. And this is really probably the secret, is that there's no other company, film company, in the world that just specializes in sports. I mean, we have cameramen that can follow a baseball off a bat. And it's just because they've been doing it for 10, 12, 13 years. And every time they've looked at it and failed, they've had a chance to see it. And we figured out why they failed. Maybe the tripod has to be changed. The balance of the camera has to be different. But it's just a fact that we've really specialized on it. Probably that's the best answer I could think of.
Are there any tricks that you've had to develop for being able to get the appropriate position for yourself on the sidelines? You know, I imagine that you're not the only photographer down there. There's newspapers and from all over that have their photographers there, and maybe some independent filmmakers or whoever also trying to get good footage at the same time you are. Do you have to elbow your way around the sidelines?
Sure, you have
to
elbow your way around the sidelines, but it's a combination of good people and really good equipment. We use very strong zoom lenses for people who are involved in photography. Maybe the fact that I could say that we have 12 to 240 lenses. That means they can zoom from a 12 millimeter, which is very wide, into a 240 millimeter, which is a telephoto. And these are specially designed lenses for us. So this enables our cameraman to get farther away from the action, and by using the zoom, he can come in close. And then when the play starts, he can pull back. But a lot of it is anticipation. They all study the game. They all have good reactions. They're all in good condition because the cameras weigh 25, 30 pounds a piece, and they've got to run up and down the field with them. But all of them are really conscientious. They work hard. We have a little school in the beginning of the year where it's like a training camp, just the way the players go through. We do the same thing. And all the fellas are, we've got to a point now where we haven't had any new people break in for 3 years. We've got such good cameramen now, and every year we have over 40 or 50 people around the country try out in different positions to shoot for us.
There's a relatively new camera invention called the Steadicam, which someone who's from the Philadelphia area
Garrett
invented.
Brown. It's a spectacular invention, although we don't really need it. It's something that's really great when you're making a Hollywood film and you want to do a tracking shot. A great example, of course, would be Rocky running up the steps of the art museum. Now, if it wasn't for the Steadicam, that shot would take all day to set up because they have to run like railroad tracks up the steps and to make sure it's smooth. But with a Steadicam, one person can do it and move up and down and get it smoothly. But we really, a Steadicam would be very chancy on the sidelines of a football game because there's so many people along the sidelines. He couldn't run up and down. Second of all, it is still a little bit cumbersome, and you've got to really be on your toes because, you know, he could get hit. A trailer pattern on a pass could come out and hit him. And it's really something that's a terrific invention, but it's something that we've tried and we really found we don't need it. It's an unnecessary luxury for us because another thing is that most of our action is shot at 48 frames per second. Now, normal sound speed, what you see at the movies, is 24 frames a second. Now, because we shoot at twice that, there isn't as much bouncing or jumping in the camera. So if you were shooting at 48 frames and walking, it would seem much smoother than if you were shooting at 24 frames and walking. And so since our cameramen almost all shoot at 48 frames, we found that they can walk and we can get away with that kind of a shot. And like I said, it takes a while to set up. And it's a beautiful piece of equipment, but it's a luxury that we really don't think that we need. It's more something for the Hollywood films.
I understand that no one on the NFL film staff is a graduate of any film school.
That's true. Most of them have been. One of them was a pastry chef. Another one was a foot doctor. Two of them played football before. One with the Chiefs and one with the Chargers. One went to. Two went to Northwestern School of Journalism. Another one sold lingerie at Penny's in Denver. And another one was a lawyer. And that's just a scattering. We just never worked out with film students because we've hired people mostly on their personality. And then secondly, on their ability to write. Because we've just felt we can teach people how to make films. It's not that hard. It's everybody feels that you have to be, you know, Wernher von Braun or Enrico Fermi to learn how to thread a projector or to shoot a film camera. It's not true. It's not that hard. The real talent we look for is a person who can write, because if he can write, all making movies is thinking, instead of using words to tell a story, you're using pictures. And it's something we felt we've been successful in teaching them. The fellow that was our cameraman of the year had never even shot a still camera up until 2 years ago. And when he came in, he was interested in shooting, and we taught him. And like I said, up until 2 years ago, he had never shot even a little brownie. And now in 2 years, he won our Sports Cameraman of the Year award. So the film students that we've dealt with, they're instructed so much out of the textbook, and it's so much meters and lenses and lights and filters and all these details that they become so constipated with facts that they can't really, they're not loose enough or not able to really go out and have fun. And that's, the film business is a fun business. It really is. And that's the way it should be approached.
Well, the staff of NFL Films also, participates in different aspects of making the film. I mean, shooting, editing, and writing, not necessarily all three for the same film, but in many places only, you know, your job is to be the cameraman and you'd never be asked or even allowed to do any writing or vice versa. Mm-hmm. I find it interesting that the people on your staff maintain that flexibility.
Right. Very important, Terry. We feel that when we hire someone, we don't like to pigeonhole them into one job. Say we hire you as an editor. Well, it could be that the fellow as an editor might develop a knack for being a photographer. So we'll let him be a photographer. A photographer can come in and maybe not do as well as we expected and end up maybe have the kind of personality where he's good in sales. We move him to sales. So we believe that, you know, it's good to have this crisscross mixture of talent. And you could go into history and you can find that some of the greatest discoveries were made by people who were in a totally different field in which they started, like Isaac Newton, who discovered gravity, was a mathematician. He wasn't a physicist. Henri Rousseau, who was the founder of the French School of Primitive Painting, was a customs inspector until he was 60, but as a hobby, he liked to paint. Giovanni Balzoni, the man who discovered the Great Pyramids of Egypt, was not an archaeologist but a circus juggler. And you can go through another great example is Lewis Carroll, who wrote Alice in Wonderland, was a high school chemistry teacher. So we've always used this philosophy that you let a person, bring them into the business, and then let them gravitate to whatever their talent might be. And it's hard for a person, you know, I started out as a writer. And then I found that I saw some shots when I started working with film. I said, geez, I think I can put these things together. Then I tried being an editor. Then after I saw the shots, I thought, well, maybe I can shoot them. So I went out and worked a camera. I mean, it's all different people have started. And our maintenance man gave us the idea of one of the greatest successes we've ever had, and that was our Nutcracker Suite. We called the Headcracker Suite, which was Tchaikovsky's music put to some of the hardest hits of the year. And that came to me, I always remember, from our maintenance man. He came up with sawdust all over his head and his glasses flecked with paint. And he says, hey, Steve, I have a great idea. Why don't we take some of this Tchaikovsky music and put it to some football? And I said, geez, that might work. And we got an editor and we did it and then ended up on the Johnny Carson show and won an Emmy Award for a short subject. So it's just that flexibility. Everybody at our company contributes and everybody has fun. And if a person is hired to be a delivery boy or a courier doesn't mean why, you know, that he couldn't come up with an idea and actually do it himself. He could write or edit. It's all very flexible.
Sometimes that flexibility changes if a company expands and gets larger and more involved with profits.
But hopefully it won't. I mean, like I said, our business is founded on the idea that you have fun first. If you have fun, then you'll be good at what you do. And if you're good at what you do, you should make money at it. And also with a sense of perspective, and that we're in professional sports. It's not like I said, we're not doing films about the Pentagon, and it's not a serious kind. It's serious in the people who are making their living, but in our approach to it, it should be fun, and it's important to keep the job in perspective. And I always remember my grandmother telling me once that, you know, that she was watching one of our shows on television on Thanksgiving, and I was explaining to her that, you know, we had to travel out to Detroit to shoot this. We had to send the crew to Los Angeles to do this. And this took three or four weeks to put together. And the music was done in Germany. And she was saying, nah, listen. And then I told her, 40 million people are going to be watching it. And she says, well, let me tell you something. She says, don't get on your high horse, because let me tell you this. If all the garbage collectors in the world disappeared and then all the filmmakers in the world disappeared, who would you miss first? So that's been sort of our perspective, and that it's a fun job, but it's not something to be, you know, it's not our films will, the fate of the universe is not riding on the outcome of the Super Bowl.
You know, it seems to me, I don't know if it seems this way to you, that sports has kind of become much more popular over the last few years than it had been the few years before that. You know, most things seem to go up and down in their popularity. And in the late 60s, early 70s, when the counterculture was really prominent, things seem to get away from sports. Like in colleges, no one was going to football games. There'd be a few people in the stands. Football teams were being voted out of existence by student councils who wanted to give the money to political organizations instead. And now that seems to have turned around. You hear lengthy sports cast on rock stations. Football is much bigger again on the college campuses. People go to games again. Do you feel that sense of trend? And if so, do you see any reasons for it?
Well, Terry, I think one reason, of course, is the physical fitness. I mean, you see so many people jogging and running and exercising, and I think that that's just a normal extension, sort of a rebirth in the interest of sports. And I think another thing is that sports just gives you a chance to get away from the tedium and the drudgery and the routine of everyday life. I mean, so many people are caught up in their jobs, and to go out on a Sunday afternoon and cheer, they can just clear their mind out. It's like I've often said, pro football is an intellectual enema, and that you can go out there. There's really of no consequence. There's nothing really that important that's happening on the field. It's not going to be have any historical significance, but is a sense of release to it, and it's also a sense of a positive release. I think it was Justice Earl Warren had a statement why he felt that sports were so popular, and he said that I open the sports pages because I just read about men's achievements and successes, whereas when I read the front pages of the newspaper, I just read about their disasters and their failures. So I think that maybe the interest in sports is that feeling of a more positive nature. Maybe the times there's a little more up feeling, a positive, a rebirth, and a lot of the cynicism has disappeared. And I think there's still some cynicism in sports. I mean, there's still
lots of it. I mean,
sure.
There's usually at least one drug scandal a year about players getting shot up with the wrong things before a game.
And it's true that you can't really deny a lot of that. I mean, professional football is a business that's in a fishbowl. I mean, you could go to any insurance company or stockbrokers, and I'm sure there are guys that are shooting up there or taking or snorting or whatever they're doing. And professional football, because it's so much in the public eye, is scrutinized closer. But I mean, sports are a mirror of our society. They've always been considered that way.
There's so much money in sports now, maybe more than ever before, and sports figures are becoming more and more like superstars. I guess some of that, in a way, I guess some of the superstar image you help create in giving us a second time close-ups on television of the people making plays. Do you think that it's good, bad, or indifferent that sports figures have become such important and highly paid figures in American life?
Well, I think it's just a symptom of our society today, that people that want to pay the $15 to see O.J. Simpson or Walter Payton run, it gives them the enjoyment that they'll do it. I think that certainly sports is not the great Camelot that everybody would like it to believe, but it's no different than any other business. It's just it's a business, but it's a but it also reflects all the same illnesses and same symptoms that our society does. But I think that one of the great charm of sports is that is the hero, like you said, the hero image, building of heroes. It's very similar to the Nordic myth of Valhalla, where the great warriors are slain, but if they die bravely, they come back again to fight again and again and again. And it's the same thing every Sunday. You can go out and the Eagles can get beaten, and you boo Ron Jaworski, but then the next Sunday he's born again, so to speak, and he plays well, and he achieves glory, and you can cheer for him, and then next week he symbolically dies in defeat again, and then the following week he's reborn to for another chance at glory. It's, like I said, a very mythic kind of an ideal, but it's something that's very basic and elemental, and I think it appeals to all people at an emotional level.
It's mythic, but in a way you kind of can predict what the story is going to be. I mean, that, someone is new on the team. Maybe they will be, and maybe it'll be someone else who will be, but one of them is going
to
get real famous.
Well, I don't know. It's hard to predict, because if you could predict, I mean, the gamblers would be making millions of money on football, and you could look at just this last weekend, just Sunday, that there were 13 games, and there were 7 of them won by underdogs. I mean, we've never had a week like we had last Sunday with incredible upsets, and that's because there's so much of professional football is emotion.
So do you ever get this world-weary feeling coming over you, like, oh, I've seen this all, and here it goes again, another season, same old stuff, or do you feel that sense of anything can happen, it's all unpredictable?
Oh, I think that I approach every season with a very fresh feeling. I think there's certain times that... You there's a sense of tedium or ennui that settles over you maybe the middle of the season when daylight saving time changes and all the shadows come over the stadiums, and we have a hell of a time trying to photograph a guy on a 50-yard run if he goes from bright sunlight into a terrible shadow. I think that's those are the things probably that if you'd say anything that would be a downer for me, that would probably be it. But I think what you said is true, is that every season, every week, there's that new, it's a rebirth, a new, you don't know what's going to happen, who's going to do well. And that's the thrill, part of the excitement of sports, is that unpredictability.
Well, the new season has just started. I guess your life has become even more hectic than it had been during the summer.
Well, it's probably, we do a lot of different things in the summer. We always have a feeling that in a creative business that we go so hard for 6-7 months during football season. And one of our biggest questions that people always ask me is, well, what do you do in the off season? Well, in the off season, we're looking through the 375 miles of film that we shot during the season and making different shows. But come around April or May, June, we take a sort of a semi-vacation, and I believe that the guys should just, we have a basketball team and a softball team and tennis teams, and most of the guys that come into work just play backgammon. But I think that's important because in creative business, it's like a fertile field. You have to let it lie fallow for a season or so before you recultivate it. Otherwise, you can overdo it and just leech it of all the creative juices that it's got and all the fertility.
Okay. Well, Steve Sable, I want to thank you very much for being here this afternoon. I'm sure almost everyone who's listening has seen some of your work. I should mention that in addition to the football highlight-type shows that are on TV, some of Steve's footage is seen on commercial films, like In Heaven Can Wait, which is a story that revolves around a football player. Steve, you shot some of the footage
right,
for that.
Right, and also in Black Sunday. And, of course, everybody remembers Brian's song. And then there was Paper Lion. But we did all the, they wanted the footage in the film to look like our footage. They wanted it to look authentic, so they hired us to do all the action footage for it, which is, you know, of course, working in a Hollywood film is a lot different. We were doing Black Sunday with John Frankenheimer, and we had both, it was the Dolphins and the Cowboys were on the field and a few of the rehearsals. And the director said to me, he says, something's wrong. And I said, what do you mean? Everything's fine. We got everybody here. He says, yeah, it doesn't look right. There are not enough men on the field. I said, what do you mean? Each team's only got 11 men. That's all there can be. He says, no, it doesn't look right. I want to put more men on the field. Give each team 15 men. And that's the way they played part of the sequences, with 15 men on each side, because the director felt it visually wasn't pleasing to his eye. But, of course, no one picked that up in the final film. But that's just a little idea of how different working on a Hollywood film is than
did
any.
Did that make you exhausted? Did that confirm your worst feelings
well,
about Hollywood?
Well, I'll tell you another thing. We worked on Semi-Tough, and they played the first part of the supposedly Super Bowl game, and nobody had chin straps on. And I brought that to the attention of Michael Ritchie, who was a director, and he kept saying, well, nobody's going to notice, no one will notice. I said, well, half these guys have beards, and it's so obvious that there's no white strip holding the helmet on. So finally they had to send out this was all being filmed on Sunday in a Dallas stadium. They had to go to a sporting goods store, like a Woolworth's 5- and 10-cent store, and buy chin straps for everybody, and had to shoot all the sequences over again. But, you know, those are the things that sports are seen on television so much that the fan, you can't fake the fan. They're aware of those things. I mean, that a quarterback can't be playing with number 55, or that, you know, the players wear chin straps, things like that. And then a lot of these Hollywood directors aren't aware of that. And when you make, that's why a lot of sports films have never been successful, is because they're so blatantly phony. But I think maybe that was why Rocky was successful, as it was, captured the grittiness and the true-to-life feeling of that lower level of the boxing strata.
Okay, well, Steve, I want to thank you again for being here this afternoon. I've been speaking with Steve Sable. He is an executive vice president at NFL Films. He was there.
Terry, do
when...
I get to do the weather report? I see that's right in front of me. And
yes,
ever since
a
little boy,
right,
I wanted to be a weatherman. That was one of my idols. One of my lifelong ambitions was to read a weather forecast, and I see it laying right in front of me, and I thought maybe I could achieve one of my lifelong ambitions right here.
Let me just do a short disclaimer and say it's the weather forecast from the morning. Hit it.
This is not today's weather forecast?
It's from the morning.
Oh,
so outdated,
well, I don't want to do I don't want to do an outdated weather forecast. I'll have to come back later as
it's
a guest
sports
to forecaster.
Fantasies, right? What's your sports fantasy?
I've always
wanted
to read a weather report, but this is out of date, so I guess I'll have to wait.
Okay. Well, Steve Sable again is from NFL Films. NFL Films is located in Philadelphia, and some of the programs that they produce, which I'm sure you've probably seen on TV, include the Game of the Week, and this is the NFL. They do the halftime film show during the NBC Monday night game. They also compete with themselves, showing pregame features on CBS and NBC. They do more stuff for TV than Mary Tyler Moore Enterprises and then any other private production company. Well, this is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, and here's a little more NFL music. Well, that was called the Championship Chase Finale from Volume 3 of the NFL Film Music album. This is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM Philadelphia.
One, dee-da-da-dee-da-da-da. You may talk about your colleges, Fair Harvard and Old Yale, and all the universities whose banners brave the gale, and all the football heroes, their glory and renown. I never went to college, but I know I've been to town. I may not be a football hero, but I'm a star with the beautiful girls. You never see me in the thick of a fight, 'cause I do my scoring mostly at night. I never tackle any dummies. I've played the best from near and far. No, I ain't. No, I'm not a football hero. But I'm a bear in a lady's boudoir. They play football on the gridiron, where the ground is rough and hard. I do my playing on a divan. The ladies all say I'm a triple threat man. I never have to call for timeout, for I'm always up to par. I ain't. No, I'm not a football hero, but I'm a bear in a lady's boudoir. I never fought for Alma Mater, because she never fought for me. The boys win a letter for not playing rough. I should get an alphabet for doing my stuff. I'm pretty good at center rushing. That's the place I really star. Oh, I may not be, I'm not a football hero, but I'm a dog in a lady's boudoir. One time I swung into action, I was rewarded with wild acclaim. The captain said to me, you're just a little runt. As long as you've been playing, you've never touched a punt. When I removed my interference, the goal was not so very far. Oh, I ain't, I'm not a football hero, but I'm a lady in a lady's boudoir.
That was Cliff Edwards, also known as Ukulele Ike, famous not only for his recordings and cameo appearances in films, but for being the voice of Jiminy Cricket. Well, this is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. 3 minutes after three is the time. Steve Sable has just left. He was here discussing his approach to filmmaking. Coming up on Fresh Air, we're going to hear from the late Charles Eames, who will discuss his philosophy of film and his approach to putting information on film.